Welcome to the WeatherPod, a podcast about the growing importance of weather information to business and society. I'm Alan Thorpe. I'm a former Director General of the European Centre for Medium Range Weather Forecasts, a former head of the UK Met Office's Hadley Centre, and a Professor of Meteorology.
And I'm David Rogers. I'm a former Chief Executive of the UK Met Office and am now a consultant with the World Bank, helping countries improve their weather-related disaster management systems and services.
Weather information is a critical international resource for saving lives, making business and society more efficient, and building resilience to extreme weather and climate change.
In each episode, we invite a leading expert to discuss how public, private, and academic sectors work together to produce weather information and make it available to business and society.
We also investigate how weather-affected public and private enterprises actually use it and the new business opportunities being created.
And because extreme weather often impacts the poorest the hardest, we'll look beyond the rich countries to the less developed ones, which host most of the world's population. Right, now it's time for Wow, That's Interesting.
Wow!
So, Alan, what have you got for Wow, That's Interesting for this episode?
Well, very unfortunately, a major train derailment on the 12th of August near Stonehaven in Aberdeenshire, Scotland, led to the death of three people after heavy rainfall washed material onto the track. In just 4 hours around the time of the accident, some 79 millimetres of rain fell in the area. A UK Met Office prediction of the chance of thunderstorms was first issued at 10 a.m. on the 8th of August 2020, 4 days before the event. Most of the UK's railway earthworks, that is the sloped ground beside the track, were built more than 150 years ago. They have steep and unreinforced slopes and are not as robust as their modern-day equivalents.
What actions being taken to prevent such disasters happening again?
Two task forces have been established to look into the management of earthworks and the best use of weather data.
Alan, tell me more about the Weather Task Force.
It aims to help the railway network operator to better understand the risk of rainfall to its infrastructure, drawing on the latest scientific developments in monitoring, real-time observations and weather forecasting.
Are current rainfall forecasts good enough to pinpoint with sufficient time for action to be taken to avert such disasters?
That's an important question. As we know, the spatial resolution of numerical weather prediction models is increasing all the time as the science and technology of forecasting improves. The aim is to capture as much local detail as possible. But in addition, we need to remember that rainfall forecasts, like all other weather data, involve a probabilistic estimate of what is likely to happen. So the question facing decision makers is, how do they react to a probabilistic forecast?
Should we expect more heavy rainfall events in future as the global and regional climate warm because of human activity?
Yes, that is possible, although the scientific issue of the change in the frequency and intensity of extreme weather events is still being addressed. In addition, the prediction of extreme weather events is also benefiting from recent developments in machine learning and data analytics. In fact, events such as those involving heavy rainfall leading to landslides and flooding underline the multidisciplinary nature of hazards. In this case, meteorology, geology, hydrology and structural engineering. This in itself presents a scientific challenge.
What about the ongoing issue of making sure that those that need the weather information receive it and act upon it in a timely and effective way?
Many organisations are typically involved in making such decisions, and this presents inevitable communications issues which must be resolved.
What's the potential for cooperation between the public and private sectors in this area?
Whilst in many countries the necessary information is provided by public organisations, there are exceptions. For example, in Japan, it's a private company, Weather News Incorporated, which provides a bespoke railway weather service for the authorities that run the railway system. So the potential for public-private cooperation is clearly there. I think such hazards remind us how multifaceted the science and technology, as well as the appropriate decision-making, actually are. In considering this one hazard, it is essential to take into account weather events, geology, engineering, climate change, and multi-organisation cooperation and communication.
You're listening to WeatherPod with Alan Thorpe and David Rogers.
In this episode of WeatherPod, we've invited Christoph Ramshorn into the studio to discuss just how the public and private sectors can work together to maximise the socio-economic benefits of weather information. Christoph is very well qualified in this area. He's part of the senior management of the private sector weather services provider MeteoBlue, and he was a lead researcher for the recent World Bank report on the power of partnership, public and private engagement in hydromet services. We'll explore some of the pros and cons and the challenges and risks of partnerships between organisations from different sectors of the global weather enterprise. And this was very much revealed in the Power of Partnership report. We really only have time to scratch the surface here of what's becoming a vital strategic issue for the global weather enterprise. So we may return to this key topic in a future episode. Christoph, welcome to the WeatherPod.
Thank you. It's great to join you.
Christoph, I'd like to start by asking you, what was the motivation for the World Bank's report, The Power of Partnership, for which you helped carry out the research and draft the document?
Well, over, as you well know, of course, over the last 2 years, stakeholders from the public, private and academic sectors had discussed the potential of public-private collaboration frequently, often at the WMO or facilitated by the WMO. It became clear that everybody understood various aspects of this complex situation quite well, but that there was no shared, clear, big picture. For example, for many national weather services, public-private engagement simply meant we sell data and services to the private sector and not much more. The World Bank GFDRR then took the initiative to create a high-level, consistent overview, or at least make a valiant attempt at it, to look at what public-private engagement could mean, and that they insisted should be backed up and exemplified by real-world examples. Then another motivation was that the World Bank was also looking for insights that could help them increase the sustainability of development projects in the hydromet domain. So the study's primary objective was to provide guidance on public-private engagement in hydromet services. It's maybe worthwhile mentioning that in the terminology of the World Bank, they always talk about hydrology and meteorology together and lump it to hydromet services because they are so closely intertwined, but that in our work, we primarily looked at the meteorological end of that.
Christoph, I'd like to start by discussing a key distinction that's often made between public and non-public weather services. And the report refers to this quite frequently. So I wonder if you could say a few words about how you see this distinction between public and non-public weather services.
Yeah, again, this actually was one of the points where we found that this distinction was between the two, public and non-public weather services, was not always well understood. Different people thought about this in different ways. So often they confused the notion of a public service with a public good and assume that public good equates benefit for the public. The economists define that slightly different. We dedicated a section of the report to this, to lay out some of the basic economic principles that we then applied to structure our findings.
Christoph, it's sometimes said the public weather forecast being a public service has to be delivered by the public sector, yet there are many examples where a private company carries out that role. Does this challenge the notion of a distinction between public and non-public services?
I don't think it challenges the distinction of those two. It rather reflects that we actually have to distinguish between a public service and the means by which it is being delivered. So that could be done either by a public or by a private entity. If you use a private entity, there is need for regulation and for service level agreements in order to make sure that the private sector does deliver quality services.
So does that mean the need, whether you have the need for regulation and service level agreements, does that negate any cost or efficiency advantages that might be gained from using the private sector to deliver a public service?
I wouldn't expect it to, because the amount of work that needs to be done is very large compared to the effort that you have to put into supervising and regulating it. And the oversight actually is something that has to be done anyway. Also internally, there are very strict quality controls in many of the established public weather services. I think actually, if you went very far down the road to outsourcing to the public sector, the biggest risk would be to start losing sufficient expertise in that regulatory agency. And that would have to be looked at carefully and managed properly.
Christoph, just to follow up finally on that point, I wonder if you could perhaps just mention, you know, how would we know whether a particular piece of weather information or a service was public or non-public? Are there examples you could mention that sort of draw out how you'd recognize those two aspects?
So, again, in the report, in this actually the same section that lays out the fundamentals, we gave a little step-by-step instruction, as it were, how one could go about identifying public versus non-public services. But the principle behind it is that we have to realize that there is a lot of cost and work involved in getting the basics right. So to operate weather stations and other weather measurements, to share them internationally so that the global models work, then to either use the results of the global models or add local or regional numerical weather prediction, and then generate the basic and the principal forecasts from that. All of that is something that needs to be carefully safeguarded, quality controlled, and kept within the international frameworks that are there in the first place to make all of this possible. But when it then comes to setting this in value, to create additional value from it, to realize the socio-economic benefits, we have found that you need quite a bit of specialized activities, where the specialization depends on in what industry sector, for example, that weather information has to be brought to bear, and with what other information it has to be combined. And it's, you know, speaking from Meteo Blue perspective, clearly a company like Meteo Blue is enabled by this early phases of the and stages of the hydromet value chain, and then tries to do a good job at the dissemination of the information and at the tailoring of the information to specific applications.
So I suppose from the point of view of member of the public, they may see the media, the TV weather forecast as a clear public service to them, and it's a very general weather forecast that applies to all of the members of the public. Whereas, I guess, a company like Meteo Blue will provide specific advice to companies as to how the weather would affect their operations, and so it becomes a very specific tailored activity, and therefore non-public. Would that be a fair summary, do you think?
I think it's a fair summary in principle, but as always, if you look at the details, you find shades of gray. So for example, the delivery of weather forecasts via public TV stations to the public is very often already outsourced as well. In Germany, for example, there are the public TV stations, and they are going through a process of rationalizing quite a few of their services. And in that, the preparation of the actual weather forecast and even the delivery of the forecast with talent in front of a camera is increasingly done by private companies.
You're listening to WeatherPod with Alan Thorpe and David Rogers.
To move on then, I wonder, did you in your research for this this report, did you discover any issues relating to the production and issuing of severe weather warnings, sort of in the context of the role of the public and private entities?
We did observe some, but they really weren't that fundamental or didn't really have to do too much with this distinction between public and private service. When there were issues, it was more that it wasn't organized too well. So when there was collaboration between the sectors, it was made clear what the authoritative voice was, it actually worked quite well everywhere. A little example was that in Myanmar, warnings are issued by the weather service, but distributed via SMS by the mobile phone operators. And it's actually part of their license to operate, to provide this service.
So if we move on to think about now more of the Power Partnership, the Power Partnership's got 11 specific recommendations regarding public-private engagement. Can we talk about a few of these in a minute? But could we start with one that recommends developing a structured, continuous and open dialogue between the public, private and academic sectors? Where did this recommendation come from and what benefits do you see coming from such a dialogue?
It's interesting that you ask this, because actually this was my initial approach into this project and led to my participation in the report. I found that the need for a structured discussion was actually expressed frequently by participants in meetings such as the Global Weather Enterprise Group, or also other meetings that I attended or participated in. And members often felt that the issues were being discussed, but continued to cover the same ground. Now, in my career, my background, although I've always been interested in weather, most of my career was in the oil industry. And there I had learned how companies plan big joint ventures that are affected by many uncertainties, unknowns, etc. And also where the participants are actually collaborators and competitors at the same time. So they have to find a good way of handling the situation and make progress. In that process, it was very important to understand everybody's motivation, their drivers for their actions, in other words. And it was very important to understand what actually the uncertainties were that affected the common plans, and to plan together how to best reduce those uncertainties. So there's a whole host of methods to do that. Various things work if you do this. It's not trivial, and it's best if one gets facilitation support and so on. But we used some of the techniques to structure our findings and also wrote a little bit more detail up in an appendix of the report.
Just to follow up, do you see that dialogue, that structured dialogue, is that a national coordinated event in each country, an ongoing event? How do you see it actually happening?
I see it happening at various levels. Certainly internationally, it has started with the WMO's open, now you have to help me.
Open consultative platform.
Yeah, thank you. And similar fora are there. There's also more and more activities around various representative bodies for the private sector. They are shaping up to actually present a form of presentation, but that clearly has to be extended and complemented by dialogue in the countries themselves. And this dialogue will take different shapes in different countries. So if you look at developing countries in Africa, for example, there are countries who have a very sophisticated planning process, and they are very good at strategizing. So that can be used to cover the strategizing component and then to complement it with involvement of the private sector. Or conversely, in other countries, there may be an already quite well-developed private sector, but that needs to combine then with some strategic thinking in the government.
To move on to one of the specific recommendations, which I guess could be seen as somewhat controversial, and it's the recommendation to minimise the role of public entities in the provision of non-public hydromet services. So I suppose, in other words, to minimise the role of a National Meteorological Service in the provision of non-public or tailored hydromet services. I wonder where this recommendation came from and why you recommended it.
We recommended it because we felt the most important thing was to maximise the socio-economic benefit of weather and data services, which of course is delivered out of the hydromet value chain. We should keep in mind that a free market is perfectly capable of providing the non-public hydromet services because they are paying customers for it. The issue is, how do you create the basics to get to the point that you can deliver those non-public services? And that part of delivering the basics is very, very important. It's very important to have public services there. But if then the public entity provides non-public services, it effectively competes in the market and thereby distorts it. This then makes it risky for the private sector to enter the market, and that in turn stifles innovation and optimization of services, something that the market is actually very good at. And ultimately, it diminishes the overall socio-economic value. And it's also important to realize that this stifling of the market can happen even if there is regulation aimed at maintaining a level playing field. Just the perception of potentially unfair competition is enough to deter certainly the small companies from participating, or makes it very difficult for them.
I guess the government has a role here to set the sort of regulatory framework. I think of some countries where the National Meteorological Service is actually encouraged to find ways to supplement the taxpayers' funds that it gets from the government by selling its services to the non-public sector.
So it's very important, number one, that this is being looked at the government level, as it is in your particular case, in your particular example. But it's also important to really consider the entire economic value and not just myopically stare at the cost of the provision of the basic services, which unlock the potential of the market.
Okay, that's very clear. Thank you, Christoph. I suppose a follow-up would be to think about whether this minimising the role of, say, a National Met Service in this context could be done in a way that promotes the role and growth of, if you like, the indigenous private sector within that country, so homegrown companies, rather than promoting foreign-owned private companies to come in to provide those services. So do you see that as a way of helping to grow the domestic capability within countries?
Yeah, actually, I think this is a great opportunity for developing countries. To strengthen the private sector in the country and actually to take advantage of the resources, the energy and the interest of people in weather services within the country. We found a lot, not in all countries, obviously, but in many developing countries, we found that there was a lot of ideas and interest around using weather service and weather services and weather data, for example, to create better financial situations, make turn unbankable by smallholder farmers into bankable smallholder farmers by providing them with a weather index insurance. So there's a lot of it going on. There is partial collaboration between those companies and the NMHS, and it should be strengthened in the sense to make sure that NMHS has a clear mandate and role, is sufficiently equipped, also financially supported to do this, and then let the market do its bit and have the benefit of the weather data being available and used in the market.
Christopher, I'm curious that when you compare an indigenous company versus an international one, I mean, assuming that an international one and a national one can provide an equal level of service, does the international one benefit from not paying local taxes or not employing people? I mean, what's this fundamental difference?
So I'm a little bit out of the depth to comment on the financial or international financial aspects of it, other than saying, of course, it will be best to have the taxes paid within the country. I would like to draw the attention to a different aspect, which is, of course, international companies could have local representations. But if you have local people that are also engaged partially in their communities, people whose career has also options in the country, and where the options in the country get better and better as, say, the market in those areas grows, that is a huge benefit that I believe is this opportunity that I mentioned initially with answering your question.
So another recommendation calls for national meteorological and hydrological services to be properly and sustainably funded according to their role as defined by a Hydromet strategy, which in turn is recommended to be developed at country level to maximize the socioeconomic benefits of the full value chain. Did you find evidence that such strategies exist? And if not, why do you think that's the case?
The strategies certainly exist if you look at the example of the United States, who went about 15 odd years ago to a similar process of establishing just how much non-public services the National Weather Service should render, and really focusing it on the enabling services. If you look at the international weather market now, which is, by the way, not very easy to assess because it's hard to get good numbers, but you certainly can see at a high level that the US has a very strong weather market with sizable companies in it, with sizable revenues in it, and with companies that compete internationally quite successfully. So yeah, there you have an example of where this was followed.
You're listening to WeatherPod with Alan Thorpe and David Rogers.
Could we, Christoph, take a look at the funding role of development partners like the World Bank? If there's a government strategy to promote national meteorological services and the role of domestic private sectors, then to what extent and how can development partners also help promote this strategy? Are current methods of financial support able to do this, or do they need modifying, do you think?
So this has two aspects. And they have both to do with the fact that while there is a lot of economic potential in getting the hydromet value chain going in a country, the cost associated with that is actually relatively low, specifically if you compare it to other infrastructure projects such as road, bridge building, etc. So there is a little bit of tendency of not paying enough attention to the hydromet services, and then maybe on top of that, nickeling and diming them. Now, a development partner like the World Bank is, of course, talking to all levels of government. And the first thing where there is an, or the first opportunity that is there, is that of advocacy. To in discussions, in meetings, in proposals, to point out what great potential there is in the hydromet value chain, and that it needs to be looked at from the government level. It's the first one. The second is, because of the technical complexity and some of the technical difficulties that you have when you want to get a hydromet value chain going, and because of this extra expertise that you need, for one. And then secondly, if you try to get the collaboration between the public, academic, and private sector going when it's not really working yet, when you look at this issue of getting this going, the best strategy actually is to look at this like a startup enterprise and start with small projects that are quite simply structured in the sense of financial controls and so on, that do not use a whole lot of money and do not need a whole lot of money, but that as small projects need to be very carefully structured and accompanied, facilitated, etc. This discrepancy between it being sort of small fish to fry, but at the same time that they should be visible at high levels of government in order to get the proper support and being directed in the right direction. There, a development partner like the World Bank is in the position to actually span this entire range of interactions.
Christoph, the Power of Partnership report analysed engagement between the public and private sector in quite a few separate countries' case studies. And you could come to the conclusion that they're all very different from each other, and therefore one can't necessarily find some common principles. But I felt anyway that the recommendations that you produced in the report did actually bring out some of the general features that were common to nearly all countries that deal with weather information. Would that be a correct assumption of mine?
Yeah, I think I'm actually quite pleased to say this, because that, of course, was the goal, one of the major challenges of the goal to of the report, to be able to do this. And maybe it's worthwhile to just highlight a few of those recommendations that we feel just apply across the board, even if the actual translation into actions may then vary from country to country. And those are really to develop a strategy at a government level, not leave it to any of the individual players to do this, although, of course, you need the input, the technical input from them. Then find the country-specific approach. I mentioned in some countries there may already be a fledgling private sector. In others, there may be none. Or some countries may have already very good government planning processes, whereas in others, one will have to help with building those. And then it was a clear requirement to fund the NMHS according to the role that it has to play. And last but not least, to do this with the help of a structured dialogue. You cannot just dictate that. That has to be developed by the three sectors together.
I just wanted to finish off our very interesting conversation by thinking about developing countries particularly. And I think the report has a couple of recommendations, and maybe you could highlight them, about how development projects should be structured to sort of improve the situation of the weather enterprise in those countries.
I mentioned in the beginning already that I felt the best metaphor for this was actually to create a startup enterprise, specifically when you think about the developing countries. And that is heavily influenced by the need to together understand what one is dealing with. So there's initially a lot of uncertainties, a lot of misunderstandings maybe, that have to be worked out. And the best way to do this, is to work together on a relatively small project that doesn't require too much financing, that doesn't require too much planning, just so that you can practice working together. So if I had to name a few bullet points, that would be: do a careful execution of one or two, not many, but one or two pilot projects, and use the methods of a lean startup. I have used this term a couple of times. There's literature around it that is quite approachable and easy to understand. And when you do that, understand and be clear about what drives the individual partners to participate in this common project. As partners, just be honest about this and work it out together. Because if that's not happening, if people say one thing and they do it for another reason, then you will not be able to sustain it. And last but not least, don't forget to involve all three sectors together and involve them from the early phases of projects. Don't start it as one party and then try to convince others. Work it out together.
Christoph, one of the things that comes up very often in developing countries and trying to get projects going is access to data. And one of the recommendations that you've made is free and open access to data. And I assume you mean by that, you know, use and reuse without restriction within the country. How will that... How can that help motivate this sort of interaction? Because I feel that it's a very important activity that must take place in order to get both public and private sectors to actually work together, because then they have common access to national infrastructure.
We have promoted open data or highlighted the value of open data policies because they do two things, among others. The first is they make it easy for people to participate in the weather enterprise. If I'm a small startup having good ideas of how it could help local farmers, then if it's easy for me to get quality data from my National Weather Service, it's going to be a huge advantage. You know, it's a make or break thing for a small company. The second is, if you make data open, it gets improved, because then people will use it. They will complain when they don't like something. They will hopefully share or praise you for providing good data. But you set up a virtuous circle where the use of the data improves it. So for that reason, we feel that open data policies should be put front and center, because they're such a strong enabler of creating socioeconomic benefits.
Christoph, thank you so much for that fascinating insight into this great report that you've produced with others, The Power of Partnership. And I think we've had a great look into the ways in which public and private and academic sectors can engage in future. So thanks very much, Christoph, for that.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thanks, Christoph.
You're listening to WeatherPod with Alan Thorpe and David Rogers.
Right, now it's time for another Wow, That's Interesting.
Wow!
So David, what have you got for this episode of Wow, That's Interesting?
Alan, we've often spoken about the need for more observational data for numerical weather prediction. That is, data that can be used for model initialization and data that's essential for model calibration and verification.
Yes, while satellites provide most of the data for model initialization, surface data has several critical roles. One in particular is the calibration of global ensembles at national and local scales by scientists from meteorological services in their own countries working with the global centers. So important steps are getting countries to recognise the importance of sharing their data and participating in improving the models.
Alan, as you know, ECMWF has made a lot of effort to increase their access to data from countries to improve the global ensembles and in turn to improve regional and national forecasts. They've shown, for example, that having access to more surface temperature and humidity data improves estimates of soil moisture, which improves forecasts of near-surface temperature and rainfall. Also, while you were ECMWF Director General, the Centre signed a Memorandum of Understanding in 2012 with RIMES, the Regional Integrated Multi-Hazard Early Warning System. This gave RIMES members from Africa to the West Pacific access to ECMWF products. But this agreement is up for renewal, and ECMWF has insisted that in order to extend it, more real-time data and some historical data should be shared with the centre.
So, how has RIMES responded to this?
Well, RIMES took up this challenge and recently concluded discussions with the DGs and senior forecasters of all 23 of its members' weather services. To my surprise, without exception, they all agreed to share more real-time and more historical data with ECMWF.
So what does this actually mean in practice?
Well, since these are non-GTS data, that is, they're not shared through existing channels with the WMO, RIMES would facilitate this data sharing arrangement, helping with telecommunication issues and ensuring that the data are available. Initially, the countries have agreed to share data from 500 additional stations. In return, they've asked ECMWF to share high-resolution digital forecast products with them, which will deepen the collaboration between RIMES members and the centre.
So just how much more data is this arrangement likely to make available, and what are the implications?
It's estimated that in a year or so, the available data will increase to 1,500 additional stations. This has important implications for the countries involved. With access to high-resolution forecast products from ECMWF, they won't need to focus so much effort on developing their own independent numerical prediction systems and can put their efforts into post-processing. In time, this could lead to greater national focus on using artificial intelligence schemes, trained using reforecast data to calibrate and downscale the outputs from the global ensembles to postcode scales. The national observations would be critical to optimise the calibration of these schemes.
Well, that concludes this episode of the WeatherPod. We hope you've enjoyed it. David and I will be back next month, and in the meantime, please give us your feedback via email support@gweforum.org.
Wow!